It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power.
And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am your host, Mark Gillar. Our special guest today is Frank Miniature, the author of Saving the Bill of Rights, Exposing the Left's Campaign to Destroy America's Exceptionalism. And Frank is the author of two other very successful books, The Ultimate Man's Survival Guide and The Politically Incorrect Guide to Hunting. Frank, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Now, one of the things a lot of people think is that Barack Obama is a or was a constitutional law professor. In fact, wasn't he really more of a low-level instructor who taught more of an introductory type class?
He was an adjunct professor. That's correct. He wasn't teaching the higher-level courses.
I didn't think so. Now, he's got an interesting twist on the Constitution. When he was a senior at Columbia, from what you've told us in the book, he expressed disappointment in the Constitution for what reason?
You know, he sees it as a list of negative charter, negative liberties, which, you know, technically that's true. That's what it is. He doesn't say that in a nice way, but that's what it is. It's a list of restrictions on government considered negative liberties. Positive liberties are things the government has to give people. You know, FDR tried to pass his second Bill of Rights in that way, and Obamacare is an example of having here's health care, the government has to give it to you, so therefore we have to also take away some individual liberties in order to give those to you.
You know, I had Daniel Hannan on the show at one point. He's a member of European Parliament, and you probably remember that little rant he went on.
Oh, I'm a big fan of his, absolutely.
Yeah, that was beautiful, wasn't it? And one of the things he pointed out when he came on my show is that the American Constitution and Bill of Rights is, you know, essentially a document that places restrictions on government. And in his country and many other countries, their constitutions are documents that give power to the government. And that is, in fact, one of the beautiful things about our Constitution, along with the Bill of Rights, Frank, isn't it, that it restricts government instead of empowering it?
No, that's exactly right. It begins, we the people. You know, it restricts the government to its enumerated powers. That's what the Tenth Amendment does, though so often, unfortunately, the left forgets the Tenth Amendment even exists. The Tenth Amendment, of course, says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution are held by the states or the people respectively. It's very clear that it's held to the enumerated powers as given by the people to the government in the Constitution. Everything else is left to the people of the states.
So where in the Constitution does it say that the federal government has the right to police the border in Arizona without the state there being involved?
You know, you get into pretty hairy constitutional interpretations there, especially when you have a state that's only trying to enforce federal laws that the federal government itself won't touch. Those are very interesting constitutional questions, and of course they're not. The states also have their own sovereignty. It's going to be very interesting when that does finally get to the high court.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually talking to you from Texas, where it's not unusual to see bumper stickers encouraging secession. So it's interesting to see what's gone on with Arizona. It really is, because the law there essentially gave people being stopped by authorities more rights than the federal government allows people being stopped if they are suspected of being in the country illegally. But I think Jesse Jackson may have nailed it on the head when he said, yeah, but the federal law isn't being enforced. So.
Now, you bring a very important point in that, unfortunately, the left too often, they see group rights. They see minority rights and gay rights and all these other group kind of rights. And that's pitting the government against the individual. Whereas if you look at the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, it specifies individual rights. You know, we're forgetting today that the smallest minority is actually the individual, and those individual rights are protected in the Bill of Rights, even though we've lost so many of them.
Well, speaking of individual rights, President Barack Obama, while he was running for office, said that he very much believed that the Second Amendment was, in fact, an individual right. Now, assess what he says versus what he has done in the past with his voting record and tell me whether or not that's actually true.
Well, he's living in a very absurd kind of contradiction that only an attorney can quite fathom. He believes that as an individual writer, at least that's what he said. But then again, he sees it as a positive right. The government can then take away when it wants to through regulation. He supported the D.C.'s gun ban, which was a complete, you know, basically a complete ban on firearms. Yet he said it's an individual right. How the two just don't go together. It's simply because he's treating it as a positive right. See, the left sees rights as coming from government. You know, that's completely absurd. How can you have individual rights that frees you to go off on your own pursuit of happiness if the government gets to grant your right and tell you when that right exists and what that right is and take it away? The Founding Fathers, of course, saw it very differently. They said, no, these rights come from God, or at least from nature. They're philosophically found in nature. They stand above government. They actually can through a jury system and so on, they can actually censor government, bring government back down. You know, the government doesn't have the moral authority. They saw these things as actually restricting government because government was the thing that came and took away your liberties. That's the big, basic battle we're fighting in right now.
You know, I know the Second Amendment is near and dear to your heart based on other books that you've written and things that you've done. I got to tell you, as someone who's a big gun rights advocate myself, Frank, I am really concerned that if this president gets reelected, that the more radical parts of his agenda, hidden or otherwise, will be to go after gun rights in a way that we've not seen any other president do. I mean, we've heard talk of labeling putting a serial number on every single bullet. We've heard about increasing taxes greatly on ammunition. Do you think that if this president gets a second term, that this will be that radical part of the agenda that we perhaps are not going to see in his first term?
There's absolutely no doubt that's what they're going to do. In fact, he said that much to the Brady campaign. It's clear that's what he wants to do. And if he got one more Supreme Court justice on the bench, it's clear if you read the two dissents in the McDonald and Heller decisions, which gave ruled the Second Amendment to be an individual right, it's clear that the minority of the left on the court, if given one more vote, they would like to take that individual right away from us. And it's just as clear that President Obama would like to seriously curtail our Second Amendment freedoms. And right now there's something being pushed through the UN on that effect. Just this week, a couple of Democratic congressmen tried to attach an amendment to a bill to take away the T-Hart Amendment, which would have left all the background checks we go through when we do buy firearms. It would have left them open to the public, so the New York Times can print them and so on and so forth. You can create gun rights, a gun owner database, and do these kinds of things with these records. They're constantly, from every facet, attacking these individual rights. Right now, President Obama is writing a series of executive orders we haven't seen yet. They're supposed to come out in the next few weeks that are, again, going to start to fringe. So it's all there.
You know, one of the things that bothered me when I started getting into guns, which was, I don't know, somewhere around November 2008, and I'm joking about that, but let me just say that our local gun owner is located next door to a Starbucks, and the day after the election, he pulled up, and there was a line going around the block, and he said, gee, I wonder what kind of crazy promotion Starbucks has going on this time. And we opened the door to his store and noticed all the people immediately began filing into his store. He realized they were there to see him. Now, I know the left likes to characterize that as, oh my goodness, it's racism. People were afraid of a black president. But I think if you look at that realistically, people were afraid of a couple of things. One is that the price of ammo was about to go through the roof. And secondly, that there might be a threat to their Second Amendment rights. I mean, what's your take on the fact that there were bumper stickers all over America during the first 6 months of Obama's term stating that he was the gun salesman of the year? I mean, I think they sold more guns, if I'm not mistaken, in the first few months of 2009 than they had sold the entire previous year. So what's your take on the run on guns and ammo after Obama got elected?
Well, it's not fear of a black president. It's fear of, unfortunately, an anti-gun Democratic president. And if you can look at this from a historical perspective and see in the Deep South after the American Civil War, how black codes were passed that literally barred freed slaves from owning firearms. And then you could follow that and trace that. The same party, that was the Democratic Party, the same party, and you look where are the most horrendous gun control laws now where you can't defend your own life in your own home, let alone on the street, and you realize it's democratically controlled inner cities, which are predominantly black neighborhoods once again. So I think it's actually the Democratic Party that it's harming black rights more than anything else and harming women's rights more than anything else. I mean, Colonel Colt wasn't kidding when he said, you know, God made me man, but Colonel Colt made them equal. It's a very basic truth. You know, we're worried about them taking away our basic individual liberties, not because of some kind of color thing.
I mean, this is just an obsession on the part of the left. I know that I think O'Reilly was interviewing John Stewart, and in almost a total non sequitur, John Stewart came back with this, you know, Bill, will you support the banning of assault weapons in this country? It just seems to me that the first step toward taking a country down that road to Marxism, or maybe even eventually communism, is to take away the ability of the people to defend themselves. Do you see this as part of a greater plan?
Well, you go right back to George Mason, you know, long remembered as the father of the U.S. Bill of Rights. He said to disarm the people, that was the best and most effectual way to enslave them. And then flash forward to right now, and you have this small arms treaty working its way through the UN, and look who are the backers on that. And you see it's dictators and so on around the world that want to disarm their own people and have disarmed their own people and see the American individualism and what we have here as some kind of a threat to them. They would like to include us in this treaty and actually disarm us. You know, when you say it like that, it sounds like a conspiracy, but boy, look it up. It's right there. And President Obama, I think, would sign that in a heartbeat. I don't think he could get it through the Senate, thanks to the NRA, but that's where we are. We have to stay very diligent, or we're going to lose this basic human freedom.
You mention in the book the concept of church and state being completely misread by the courts, although I think it took them about 150 years before there were enough liberals in the court that they could misread it. But was the First Amendment ever meant to mean that you can't set up a nativity scene in front of the local city hall?
No, and that's a very important point. And this is the kind of points where I'm hoping people, if not read my book, then at least study the Bill of Rights, because it's just been so warped and all these freedoms are being taken away from us. No, that separation of church and state, that so-called wall, was taken out of one letter from Thomas Jefferson in 1803 that he sent to the Danbury Baptist Association, where he referred to a wall between church and state. And I print most of that letter in the book for the basic reason that if you read it in context, he was saying the state, the government, federal government, can't establish an official religion as they had in England. Very clearly, that's exactly what he's saying, which is what the First Amendment says. The First Amendment doesn't want to chase all that is holy out of the public square. That is not what it's for.
Now, my understanding is at the time that we were writing the Second Amendment, there were many states, in fact, who had an official state religion.
About half the colonies, of the original, had official state religions. That's completely correct.
So this was just saying that the federal government could not have it. What they were trying to avoid was a situation, you know, like they had faced in England, correct?
Exactly. They didn't want that official state religion coming from the centralized federal government. And in the end, they ended up, all the states, they gave up their centralized state idea of a religion, which weren't as corrupt and overbearing as England was at that time, where they would literally stop anyone from practicing in public, Catholicism or Quakerism or whatever they wanted to. That didn't really occur here in that regard. But yeah, it eventually happened that way, and we ended up towards this idea of incorporation, which is unfortunately on very weird ground from progressives in the early 20th century on the court decided to say, well, the Bill of Rights can also apply to the states and local municipalities, through this Articles of Incorporation, and the Supreme Court gets to decide on, you know, which ones of these, not just going to apply the whole Bill of Rights to the states, and which ones of these also, you know, include these other governments. Of course, we've gotten so far down that road of incorporation now, there's no way to turn that back, and I'm not saying we even should, but that's the process we've gone through.
Was it frustrating when you saw Christine O'Donnell being attacked for saying that the words separation of church and state do not appear anywhere in the First Amendment? It was hilarious, I thought, to see that happen. But what were your thoughts as left-wing broadcaster after broadcaster was saying, Christine O'Donnell is so stupid, she doesn't even know that separation of church and state is in the First Amendment?
You know what depressed me most about that exchange was that she didn't explain clearly that, you know, this came from one letter and was used by Justice Hugo Black, the 1947 Everson decision, and taken out of context. But she could have very easily pulled apart that liberal argument, but it didn't occur to her at the time, or she didn't have the facts at hand. I was actually screaming when I saw that. Oh, read my book, come on, oh boy, come on, the facts are right there. You can pull that liberal argument apart, and we need to. And there's no reason why government should be chasing all of this holy out of the public square. Why you can't go to school wearing a t-shirt saying Jesus loves you. That's insane.
I think it is very insane, and what's also insane is the number of attorneys in this country that would tell you that those words are in the First Amendment. And I've heard stories of other people who were big on spreading the word about this, you know, tossing an attorney a copy of the Bill of Rights and saying, well, show me. And they can't do it. And then ask the attorney, well, didn't you study this when you were becoming a lawyer? And, well, we never actually had to read it. They just told us what was in there. So anyway, even attorneys don't get it. So I guess we can't be that upset with broadcasters and with members of the general public who don't get it.
Right. The word just needs to get out. It's such a basic truth, and it's so easy to tear apart. And the idea that also that the Republican Party are somehow racist, it bothers me, especially if you look at history and realize that the Republican Party is the one who fought, you know, to end slavery. The Republican Party passed, you know, the 14th and 15th Amendments to try to end slavery. More Republicans voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Act than Democrats did, and actually a block of Democrats in the South tried to stop that Civil Rights Act from going through. It just really bothers me because Republicans, if you look really to the right of what they were supposed to be, they put the individual in front of the state. They're individualists. They believe each individual. Racism can't apply because if you look at someone's race and you're judging them by a group, that's right there. It's ripping away the idea that they're an individual and should be taken on an individual basis. It's the left, through history and today, that looks at them as being a member of a group and is therefore racist.
A couple of quick things about what you just said. First of all, I know some of that came from the opening of your book where you discussed this debate that you had with a liberal college professor at a cocktail party. And I got to tell you, Frank, and I want my listeners to really listen closely to what I'm about to say, that little exchange, which you've captured in writing, is one of the best summary shooting down every single myth that the left has about the right. And I got to tell you, if for no other reason, although there are many, buying this book just to read that summary of the exchange you had with the liberal professor is worth the price of the book. That is one of the best summaries shooting down all the myths that the left likes to throw at the right that I've ever seen. So I want to congratulate you on that. Well, well written.
Oh, thanks. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, I'm not just saying
that. That is what the study of the Bill of Rights can really give you, is that deep understanding of the philosophical divide between the left and the right, so that we all are able to then tear them apart in a cocktail chat or wherever it is we run into someone of that, you know, leader of that persuasion.
You talk about the freedom of speech being infringed upon as well. And the minute I read that, a few examples immediately popped into my head. One was when Robert Gibbs was saying, you know, we know there are a lot of really incorrect things being said about our proposed health care bill. And if you get an email or someone tells you something and it just doesn't sound right, and it, you know, forward that on to us because we want to see that. You know, that was a definite Big Brother moment. And then another one that I can recall is whenever they were running for office, when Obama was running for office, and they basically told all the television stations across the country, if you run that ad with featuring, Bill Ayers saying that, you know, Obama palled around with Bill Ayers, you know, this might lead to your FTC license being, no, I'm sorry, not FTC, FCC license being pulled. And then my favorite one was whenever insurance companies were basically doing what their fiduciary obligation required them to do, and that was inform their shareholders that the Obama health care bill could lead to a loss of profits and that they were going to have to raise premiums in order to survive. They basically were told, if you keep saying that, if you put something else out like that again, you're not going to be allowed to participate in the insurance exchange, which essentially meant they weren't going to be able to do business. So are those three examples of what you're talking about?
Yeah, in fact, let me take that to another level that really shocked me is when I, in researching this book, I went in and talked to the leaders of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and I asked them why they hadn't stood up against, in a stronger way, the campaign finance laws that didn't allow them to run ads within a certain number of days of primaries and elections. In other words, to fight for people who will loosen the regulations on them or at least make them more just and who will lower the taxes on them so they can do more business and compete in this world economy and so on, and go against the people that are trying to destroy their businesses. And, you know, right now we're in a position where the government gets actually picked the winners and losers so often. And I was just appalled, and they said, no, our members are just not willing to stand out on that plank because they're going to be destroyed by this administration in a PR sort of campaign. And if those sort of attacks start and they only lose, let's say, 10% of their consumers, then they've become that much less able to deal with their board, and their stock price will fall, and all these things will happen. They're going to lose their positions. So none of them were willing to put their neck out there. It took a small nonprofit, Citizens United, to make a video on Hillary Clinton and then to fight. And they made that video for the specific reason of picking that fight for their freedom of speech. You know, it appalled me so much that unfortunately our corporations are so beaten and so worried about the public appearance they might have on an attack by a politician that they were completely unwilling to stand up for their right to free speech.
Well, this is an administration, is it not, that has shown a greater tendency to reward its friends and punish its enemies than anything we've seen in a long time?
Well, look at GE. They didn't pay taxes last year, and yet they're getting all this stimulus money. Wow, right, they're in bed with them, and we tend then to point at the lobbyists and say the lobbyists are evil. Well, actually, if you look at lobbying grows as government grows, and I think it would recede if government receded. People, you know, they have to go in, and that's a First Amendment right to petition your government. I don't like to look at lobbyists. Look at government. Look at the way the strings that they're putting on all these corporations to pull them this way and that way. It's really gotten to be a place that we're heading towards this European socialized state. And I'm hoping we'll look at the 10th Amendment again and say, wait a second, they're supposed to be reined into their enumerated powers in the Constitution. Let's shrink government down to where it was supposed to be, to what made America great in the first place.
Your book also mentions the increasing infringement upon property rights. Speak to that, if you would.
Well, right. I went and interviewed Suzette Kielo, who I'm sure we all know from Kielo Vino London, when she lost her own property. You know, they literally came to her house the day before Thanksgiving and pounded, when she was away working, she's a nurse, pounded this eviction notice with nails through her front door to tell her she had to get off her own property so they'd give her property to Pfizer, the largest pharmaceutical company in the world, because Pfizer would pay more in taxes. Now, okay, that's horrendous enough, you know, especially in the land of the free and the home of the brave, but then she goes through the court system and she loses in the lower court, and then she loses in a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court. Well, she looked at the Fifth Amendment and says, you can only take it for public use. That's what it says in the Fifth Amendment, meaning for a highway or a dam. You can't take it to give it to some other private corporation because they're going to pay more in taxes. But no, back in the 1950s, the Supreme Court in Berman and the Berman decision had changed the meaning to mean that they could actually take it for a public purpose. So they actually changed a word on our Fifth Amendment, the Supreme Court did, in order to take this right to property away from us. So here she lost her property. Now, if you go there, Pfizer never even built there. It's an empty lot. That's what happens when government gets involved in this way. And she lost her property. Luckily, someone did move her house. Her house still exists on another place in New London. But if this can happen in America, if they can even take away our right to property, which they have, and we have to have Congress pass a bill that brings us back. 42 states have done that, but Congress needs to act because there are some states that haven't. I'm in New York where it hasn't. They're still seizing properties for very weird reasons. Right, we've lost our property rights.
We were speaking earlier of this government's willingness to reward its friends and punish its enemies. One of the things that I find incredibly interesting, and this is going to be a bit off topic, but I would like your take on it, is that from the minute Barack Obama released that long-form birth certificate, we started seeing people come forward finding all types of anomalies in it. I mean, it had kerning in it, which is a writer I'm sure you know, but I'll say for the listeners, is moving letters closer together and farther apart in order to make them look more aesthetically pleasing, which could not have been done by a 1961 typewriter. We saw in some lines multiple fonts, which could not have been done by a 1961 typewriter. There was a lack of chromatic aberration. There are a number of things wrong with this document that should be causing the media, especially the conservative media, and members of Congress, dear Eliza, to go nuts on this thing and demand an investigation. Yet after watching Obama beat up Donald Trump at the press dinner, the entire country, except for people in the blogosphere, are silent about this. What's your take on why no one will even address this issue? Is this a feared president, a feared administration?
Well, it's become a toxic issue, and they've managed to point it as you're seen as a nut if you talk about this. I found it very interesting that very little talked about is that the day before they released the birth certificate, Hawaii announced that they're no longer going to open these records up to people. So those records were sealed basically. Right there, nobody could go and find the original and compare it to this one or vice versa. I'm not saying that this isn't, that he wasn't born. I don't know where he was born, to be honest with you. It's a very strange coincidence, right there. But yeah, people are afraid to go up against the machine is what it's become.
It definitely has. It's probably just, Chicago hardball politics at its best, despite all the promises for hope and change and transparency. I mean, this is pretty much just Chicago hardball politics, isn't it?
Yeah, it gets pretty dirty and it goes back and forth. And I think he's starting, even by the left, to be seen that way. And they're starting to understand what this really means. And you can't have it both ways, especially over this whole debt struggle that's going on. Now it's getting a bit juvenile, I think, especially from the White House. So I think people are seeing through it.
Now, you say in your book that the American people need to be willing to fight to protect the Bill of Rights, to keep you from getting blamed the next time someone is shot in Arizona. Can you tell us exactly what you meant by fight? What do you expect the American people to do to protect the Bill of Rights?
Oh, I do not advocate violence in any form, and I don't talk about it in that context whatsoever. I'm saying we have to understand these liberties in order to retain them, and we need to vet the politicians as they go to Washington, as the Tea Party is so wonderfully starting to do, so that as they go through the primary process, we pick somebody who's, when they raise their right hand, is going to uphold the Constitution. It's very clear. Thomas Jefferson said this very well. He said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. I think that's where we are, and we have to understand these. I think very few people really know what's in their Bill of Rights. They have a few, they understand the first a little bit, though a lot of them think it's a positive right and so on. But they really just aren't in touch with that these were meant to be restrictions on government protecting the individual. I think that's even the very definition of American exceptionalism is the ability to go off on our own pursuits of happiness, and they laid that out in the Bill of Rights as those individual rights stopping the government from getting in our way of going off on our own pursuits of happiness.
I'm going to be honest, I haven't finished the book, but I've read enough of it to know that I like it, and I get books in the mail all the time, and oftentimes I'm not able to go back and finish them. I can assure you, Frank, this is one book that I'm going to curl up with and finish. In fact, I'm taking a little vacation in about a week, and this book is coming with me. I love what I've read so far. I think it should be mandatory reading for anybody in this country, especially Tea Partiers who want to preserve the freedoms that our founding fathers gave us. They came originally from God. I think originally the word God was used in the Constitution, and they changed it at one point, did they not, to nature or... I can't recall, but at any rate, the bottom line here is that this is a wonderful read, and education is you know, we talked about the importance of the Second Amendment and people retaining the right to bear arms. Education, actually, I think, is even more important than that. Staying apprised on the issues, and this book does that for people. Why don't you tell my listeners exactly how they can get a hold of a copy of your book?
Oh, they can get it anywhere. Books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, available really everywhere.
Fantastic. I tell you what we'll do. We'll throw up, at the very least, an Amazon.com link to your book. And those people who are familiar with our show and our website, TeaPartyPowerHour.com, we have a recommended book section of which we will certainly include this particular book. And what we do is we like to place the book there and then place a link to the radio interview directly underneath it so people can get to know the author and you know, before they buy the book. So we'll definitely include you in our recommended reading section as well, Frank. That's pretty much all the time we have, but I want to thank you for coming on. Much success with this book. I assume it's flying off the shelves already, and we'll do everything we can to help you sell a few more copies through our website.
I appreciate it. It was good to talk to you.
Oh, fantastic. And Frank, with that, we are done. I'll give you an off-air thank you as well. I really appreciate you coming on. I meant what I said about the book. I think it's well written, and the little exchange between you and the snooty English professor, I think, justifies the price of the book, and everything else is just gravy.
That was a real conversation, by the way.
No, I believed it. I believed it. I could tell. I'm talking to you from College Station, Texas, the home of Texas A&M University, and I bump into these people all the time. And it's kind of interesting because in Texas, you wouldn't think that you would be overhearing that many, especially this part of Texas, home of the George Bush Library. You would think you wouldn't, you know, listen in on these types of conversations. But, you know, I've been in restaurants where, you know, five or six professors are at the table next to me saying, you know, we've got to turn Texas into a blue state, you know, and the only way to do that is to register more minorities. We got to get out there and register them because, you know, Texas is going to be a red state forever if we don't get these minorities registered, you know. And I'm just thinking a lot of minorities, especially Hispanics, voted for George W. Bush. You know, I wouldn't count those chickens before they hatch, but
we just have to help them wake up, absolutely, and see why they wanted to come here in the first place. And I think we'll do just fine.
I can tell you I am encouraged by the fact that we have in this area a local Hispanic conservative group that has cropped up about 100 miles north of here. There's one that's formed in Waco. I'm working with now a gentleman in the South Texas area who is telling me that there are, you know, large numbers of Hispanics interested in the Tea Party down there. And I think the left is in for a bit of a surprise, you know, come the next election. I think anyone is capable of, and this is how my dad always likes to put it in his own folksy way, and, you know, everyone may not have time to be totally apprised on the issues, and Lord knows I've been guilty of that for many, many years until, you know, 2008 when I really woke up. But most people tend to vote their pocketbook. And I think it's a very simple thing. You know, you said we've got to wake them up. It's a very simple thing to look at your checking account and your savings account 4 years later and ask that question, am I better off?
No, you're 100% right. Hopefully they won't be tricked into understanding why it occurred the way it's occurred. You know, all the demagoguery going on right now and the blaming of corporations when it's that freedom to entrepreneurship that has gotten everything we have today in this country.
Well, liberals don't understand the concept that you actually increase federal revenue by cutting taxes. And also, it's so funny when liberals will say, you know, well, you can't blame Obama. He's just trying to clean up Bush's mess. And, well, what exact legislation did President, you know, what bill did President Bush sign into law that created this economic mess? And they'll tell you, oh, well, you know, he deregulated Wall Street. And it's like, well, that was the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act that took away much of Glass-Steagall. And even though three Republicans sponsored it, it was overwhelmingly supported by both parties and signed into law by William Jefferson Clinton. So how exactly is it Bush's fault? How did Bush deregulate Wall Street? And I've had people just turn red in the face arguing with me that it was George W. Bush who signed Graham-Leach-Bliley into law. It's amazing. They can't bring themselves to admit that, you know, I'll give you an example. Chuck Schumer made an impassioned speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate for people to support, for fellow senators to support this law. Joe Biden was a big fan of it. So, you know, and then so they can't wake up to the fact that their own party helped deregulate Wall Street, even though it was definitely a bipartisan effort. And, you know, people just don't get it. I mean, they really think that George W. Bush, and by the way, the deregulation of Wall Street was only part of the problem. I mean, you had Acorn out there twisting arms, and even banks that
had Penny and Freddie. Fortunately, Bush wanted to reform them and wasn't given the opportunity.
I think on three different occasions, the Bush administration called for the reform of Fannie and Freddie. And I have videotape of the Chuck Schumers, Chris Dodds, Barney Franks, Maxine Waters of the world saying mm-hmm. that Fannie and Freddie were just fine and that it should be left alone. I think Barney Franks' exact words were, it's fundamentally sound. But, you know, the Community Reinvestment Act only applied to about 25% of the banks. But between Henry Cisneros and Acorn, they twisted the arms of banks that didn't fall under that. So, anyway, I'll shut up. Go ahead.
You're in Texas, and you're talking a lot about Bush. My younger brother just went to work as his editorial director.
Oh,
he
where?
Might be a good person for you. I was working out of Dallas. I think that's where the Bush's office is.
Oh, nice.
Moved to Dallas.
Well, tell him to give me a call, or you can tell me how to contact him.
Yeah, I'll send you his email address.
Okay. Do you have mine? Mine is mark@teapartypowerhour.com.
Okay, that's easy.
Yeah. Hey, Frank, I'm sorry we ran out of time so soon. This is a two-part show today, and now I've got to interview Jedediah Vila, so got to let you go. But I would like to have you back on the show sometime so we can get further into the book. I feel like we barely scratched the surface.
Absolutely, anytime.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Thanks for being with us today.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.